Part 2. Early Commentaries. Chapter 5. Ja'far as-Sadiq, Shi'ite Imam and Quranic Exegete, 760 CE. Ja'far was an early interpreter of the Quran. He was an imam, one endowed with divine authority. His authority was, above all, conferred through his bloodline. It was a bloodline unlike that of anyone else in the history of Islam. Until very recently, blood descent mattered in most societies. It determined life options. A sacred lineage conferred moral authority. Europeans used to call it beatostirps, holy roots that nourish and define the person blessed to have them. Among Muslims, the line of those who traced themselves to the Prophet Muhammad through his daughter Fatima and her husband Ali were thought to have the authority of both kings and saints. They were especially blessed from birth by virtue of their parentage. After Fatima, the line was patrilineal. It began with Ali, the cousin, playmate, devout follower, fellow warrior, then son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. Ali became the first imam of Shiite Islam. Ali had two sons, Hassan and Hussein. The Prophet's grandsons, and therefore his closest male heirs, they became the second and third imams. The principal Shiite lineage continued through the offspring of Hussein, despite the latter's martyrdom in the notorious Battle of Karbala that took place in 680. Ja'far as-Sadiq became the sixth imam. He was the great-grandson of Hussein and also one of the designated successors to Ali, his great-great-grandfather. But his beatostirps ran even deeper. Ja'far as-Sadiq was not only one of the people of the Prophet's household, all al-Bayt, he also had another lineage that linked him back to the Prophet's generation. He was descended from both Aisha, the Prophet's favorite wife after Khadija, and from Fatima, Khadija and Muhammad's oldest daughter, as well as Ali's wife. Imams rely on lineage, but they also depend on character. Ja'far is known as as-Sadiq, or the Truthful One, because it was his dedication to truth that made him the most important of the Shiite imams after Ali and Ali's younger son, the martyr Hussein. None of this complex genealogical reckoning would matter had Ja'far not also been an exceptional scholar. His learning was prodigious. He lived and taught in Medina at a time when Sunnis and Shiites had different views but were not yet competing camps within the Muslim community. Among his students were Abu Hanifa and Malik ibn Anas, who became founders of two of the four Sunni schools of law. Malik ibn Anas leaves no doubt about the close friendship that existed between him and Ja'far as-Sadiq. Their collaboration helped shape Islamic norms and values for all periods, and it also suggests the fluidity of the lines between the two major groups defining Islam in the second Hijri or Muslim century. Sunnis accepted the history of the Muslim community, or Ummah, as it had unfolded. All the righteous caliphs were indeed righteous, while Shiites saw that history differently. Ali was the most righteous of the righteous caliphs. Indeed, the other caliphs, but especially his immediate predecessor, Uthman, were less righteous because they did not defer to Ali. Ali's delayed caliphate, and even more the martyrdom of his son Hussein, represented, for Shiites, a betrayal of the ideals of the earliest Muslim community. The Shiites preferred their imams, who lacked political power, to the caliphs, who exercised political power. There was no full-scale cleavage between Sunnis and Shiites until the Abbasid Revolution. The Abbasids revolted against the Umayyads in 747 CE with support from proto-Shiites, that is, those who were linked to the Prophet's family and to the memories of Ali and his martyred son Hussein. Even after the Abbasids came to power and established Kufa as their new capital, other branches of the Prophet's household continued to protest. Some revolted against Abbasid rule, just as their predecessors had earlier revolted against Umayyad rule. Yet Jafar as-Sadiq neither joined them nor supported their cause. He preferred to be an academic luminary and a political quietist. Throughout the early 750s, he maintained the stay-at-home policy of his father. Living in Medina, he did not pose an immediate threat to the Abbasid caliph in Kufa and was left alone. However, in 753 CE, a new Abbasid caliph came to power. Al-Mansur was intent on securing his rule. He tried to use the intellectual elite, including Jafar, to establish a theocratic state with himself as the vice-regent of God. He also justified the rights of his family to the caliphate by referring to his bloodline. Even though it was not as strong as Jafar's, he claimed that he and his offspring, since they were direct descendants of the prophet's uncle Abbas, had equal claim to the imamate. In 760, Al-Mansur proclaimed himself the Imam Caliph. This double claim was too much for Jafar to bear. As the designated imam of his generation, he had to oppose the caliph on two grounds. First, according to the Shiite notion of authority and succession, the imamate must remain distinct from the caliphate until such time as God would make an imam victorious. Second, the imam can only be a person descended from the prophet through his daughter Fatima. The imam derives his exclusive authority not by political claims, but by explicit designation from the previous imam. He also inherits a special inner knowledge, or ilm, passed down through holy blood from generation to generation. Still, Jafar's opposition took not a political path, but an intellectual path that wove itself through the Quran. By 760, Jafar had become more than just an elder statesman for the Al-Bayt. He was a respected Quranic scholar. Some claim that he actually wrote a commentary on the Quran. While it has not survived, one can easily gauge some of its principal points by consulting later commentaries written by Shiite scholars. Jafar offered a threefold view of the Quran. The first and most obvious reading was literal. One could read the text in Arabic. By the time of Jafar, however, much of the language of the Quran was not the same as everyday Arabic. And so one aspect of interpretation was to translate Quranic Arabic into vernacular Arabic. But more than translation was necessary to understand the context of verses, chapters, and themes from a book of signs. That second level of interpretation was historical. It required understanding the circumstances of the time of the Prophet and the first Muslims. Of course, it also meant understanding the events that determined a line of succession that bypassed the Al-Bayt and instead fell to the Prophet's close companions, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman. Together with Ali, these three were known as the righteous caliphs. But their righteousness had to be reevaluated in light of Ali's moral superiority. The third level went further still. Going beyond both language and history, it explored the realm of imagination, of myth, of intuition. Some have called it the allegorical approach to the Quran. It was the most tortuous and least accessible way to experience the mysteries of a book of signs. Yet this third way, the allegorical way, offered the most creative and open-ended of all the ways to engage the noble Quran. Jafar was especially adept at the second and the third, even though it was often difficult to distinguish between them. Ali, for instance, due to this close relationship with Muhammad, must have been present at some of the revelations that became a book of signs or the noble Quran. Lacking explicit mention of Ali in the Quranic revelations, how can one detect indirect references to him and also to his family? This was a question that motivated much of Imam Jafar's effort to make sense of a book of signs. Like other descendants of the house of the Prophet, Al-Bayt, who became known as Shiites or partisans of Ali, he distinguished between clear and ambiguous verses. As the imam of the time, Ja'far as-Sadiq was respected as the most authoritative source of that knowledge, which includes esoteric as well as evident meanings of the Quran. He could move deftly between clear verses in which there is no room for demurral or difference in their interpretation, and other ambiguous verses that require multi-leveled interpretation and often evoke disagreement, even among believers. Like Tabari in the 10th century, Imam Ja'far prized the clear verses. Any believer should be able to comprehend their meaning. However, unlike Tabari, he ascribed still greater importance to the ambiguous verses. These, in Imam Ja'far's view, were the verses where the meaning is not clear except to those who have the authority to interpret them, namely the imams. Ali, for instance, is said to have declared that no less than one quarter of the Quran is about the imams. The imams are the truthful ones, chapter 9, verse 119, and the possessors of knowledge, chapter 3, verse 6. They are also those linked to the people of remembrance, chapter 16, verse 43 through 44, and to the party of God, Hezbollah, chapter 5, verse 56. It is they who are the family of the Prophet. This is the good news that God gives to His servants who believe and do good works. Say, I ask no reward from you for this, only the affection due to my kin. Chapter 42, verse 23. Among other verses allegorically referring to the imams are the signs of God. Only the unbelievers would deny our signs. Chapter 29, verse 49. Each imam is taken to be a sign of God. Ayatollah. Chapter 7, verse 9. Chapter 10, verse 7. Chapter 22, verse 57. Chapter 38, verse 29. The straight path becomes the way designated by the imams. Chapter 1, verse 6. But also chapter 6, verse 153. Chapter 15, verse 41, chapter 16, verse 76, chapter 20, verse 135, chapter 43, verse 42. The bounty of God, chapter 14, verse 28 through 29, is the imams, and they are also the cord of God, chapter 3, verse 103, as well as the firmest handle, chapter 2, verse 256. The light of God is especially important since it designates not just the imams but also their quasi-divine character. Then believe in God and His messenger and the light that He has sent down. Chapter 64, verse 8. While Sunni Muslims would dispute all these references, it is the last reference connecting the imams to light that provokes the sharpest difference. It projects not just a different notion of the imams, but also of the Prophet. Muhammad was said to be but a man, as were all the prophets before him and all the successors or caliphs after him. Yet chapter 64, verse 8 is the locus classicus, the most famous text for identifying both Muhammad and the imams with the light of God. Although there are also several other verses, such as chapter 4, verse 174, chapter 6, verse 122, chapter 7, verse 157, chapter 9, verse 32, chapter 24, verse 36, chapter 57, verse 28, and chapter 66, verse 8. Despite the quiescent nature of Ja'far's opposition to the caliph, his teaching, and especially the exclusive authority he ascribed to himself as an interpreter of the Quran, undermined the claims of al-Mansur. The caliph had Ja'far arrested and brought to Samarra, where he was kept under supervision. After a few years, al-Mansur allowed Ja'far to return to Medina, but then sent the governor of Medina instructions to poison him. In 765, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq died and was buried in Jannat al-Baqi, the Garden of the Eternal in Medina. His preeminence among Shiite, as also Sufi or mystical Quran interpreters, persists up to the present day. even though Saudi claimants to Medina, aghast at tomb cults focused on saints and imams, destroyed Jannat al-Baqi in the early decades of the 20th century.